Si ça marche.
It's a pleasure today to have the speaker from Milano, Mari Polletta. As usual, a few lines of her biography. Mari started the studies in astronomy at the University of Bologna. Then she graduated at the University of Geneva, where she started the first postdoc. She moved to, during this time, she visited the Caltech, and indeed in Pasadena at IPAC, she did her first, another postdoc, then moving to University of San Diego for postdoctoral research. And then she came back with a Marie Curie Fellowship to Europe, actually to Paris, to the Institut d'Astrophysique de Paris. She has been visiting a researcher at IRAP in Toulouse before being appointed as a research scientist at the Institute of Special Astrophysics, right, in Milano. Mari is a member and a co-chair of several projects, including SWIRE, VIPERS, where I met her, and XXL, which is the X-ray survey operated by XM Newton satellite. She's a specialist of the astrophysics of high energy objects, so AGN, galaxy clusters, and protoclusters, which are the topics of this seminar today. I invite, that's the presentation. I invite everyone to interrupt Mari at any time for questions. It's up to you, Mari, thank you.
Thank you, Carlo, for the invitation and for the nice introduction you started. And thanks everybody for joining you. I don't see you, but I think I know some of you. So I'm gonna talk about a project that I started working on when I was visiting IRAP in Toulouse. And among the founders of the project, there are all people based in France, including Guylaine, that might join us later. Now we are a smaller group working on this project spread all over the world. Here is the core team. And a lot of people are in France, Geneviève Soucaille, Hervé Doll, Matt Lennert. And in the course of the project, there were students and postdocs that have contributed to the results I will present, but they are now all gone. And then for specific projects, we had the help of additional people listed here. So in this presentation, I like to give you my point of view for why protoclusters are such a hot topic today and why they are so interesting. And whatever science you do, probably you will find some interest in studying protoclusters. And then I want to show you how the legacy of the Planck telescope goes beyond the cosmological parameters of the sample of massive clusters discovered through the Zolayev-Zaldovich effect, but it also left us with a homogeneously selected sample of protocluster candidates. And then the summary of my results in a nutshell can be summarized in what looks extraordinary might be ordinary at higher redshifts. And finally, I'll try to make an assessment on on how our understandings of the growth of these structures by comparing our results with prediction from cosmological simulations. So what is a protocluster? It's an ensemble of dark and baryonic matter that will collapse into a massive cluster by redshift zero. So they are usually discovered at high redshift above 2 and up to 6 or 7. And they are large structures in the sky, up to half degree or tens of megaparsec, and galaxies distributed in filaments and clumps, so it's not homogeneous, and it's not collapsed yet, so it cannot cannot be, is not virialized, and so cannot be detected in the X-ray through diffuse X-ray emission from the hot gas, and not through the Sunayev-Zeldovich effect in the millimeter. And in terms of the galaxy members, we know that in clusters, galaxies are predominantly massive and passive. So in protoclusters, we see these galaxies growing. We see their progenitors. So they will be star-forming galaxies. At one point, we may see them turning off, quenching, and this could be associated with some AGN activity. And this is what we want to investigate. So what can we study in this system? We can look at the origin of the star formation that is occurring in these systems. The star forming activity is rapid and is earlier than what is observed in the field, and it's intense. So we can probe different scenarios like mergers or gas accretion. We can look at the buildup of these massive galaxies that we see today at the time where they are growing stars. So it's like studying dinosaurs live instead of using fossils. We can investigate the quenching mechanism that halt this activity in these galaxies. And we can analyze, investigate the role of the environment in galaxy evolution. And many other things like the growth of structures, the buildup of the intracluster medium, and also provide constraints to cosmological parameters. So how do we look for them? So successful technique, I have looked at sources that are associated with massive halos with overdensities, like submillimeter galaxies, quasars, high redshift radio galaxies. And by knowing the redshift for these tracers, it has been possible to look for galaxies at the same redshift and identify overdensities. Another technique is to carry out narrowband imaging on wide fields that detect a strong emission line like Lyman alpha or H alpha at a specific redshift. And so these are able to identify Lyman alpha emitters or H alpha emitters. And here there are some examples. And finally, if you have a highly sample spectroscopic survey on a wide field, you can look for overdensity peaks in the spectroscopic redshift distribution. So we wanted to look for the protoclusters with the highest star formation rates. So how do we find them? So according to cosmological simulations, this protocluster hosts intense star formation activity. And we know that the galaxies with the highest star formation rates are these dusty star forming galaxies, those with a peak in emission in the far infrared. And we also know from theoretical models that the progenitors of this massive passive galaxy that we see in today's cluster are dusty star forming galaxies. So we want to find overdensity of dusty star forming galaxies. And how do we find them? So this is the average spectral energy distribution of a dusty star forming galaxy. The emission peaks in the far infrared, around 100 microns in the micron in the rest frame. When this peak, when this source is redshifted at high redshift, ratio of 2, 3, or 4, this peak moves into the submillimeter. And so if we have a machine sensitive to multiple submillimeter bands and able to collect emission over wide areas, we can find the regions of the sky where we have a lot of emission here, which can be associated with an overdensity of dusty star-forming galaxies. And this machine is Planck, because Planck has surveyed the whole sky with a wide beam, 5 arc minutes. And so using Planck, we were able to identify more than 2,000 protocluster candidates distributed all over the sky in the northern and southern hemisphere. The galactic plane was masked. And here you see some 20 arc minute by 20 arc minute cutouts. And what you see is this blob, which is the emission that Planck finds. But of course, to know more about these sources, we needed to have follow-up observations at high resolution. So we observed them, about 200 of them with Herschel. These are the same fields now with Herschel, combining three submillimeter bands, so the same that Planck observed. And the yellow contours represent the overdensity significance. So you will see at the center of these contours a large number or larger than in the field of Herschel sources that have red colors, implying a redshift greater than 2. And if we take those sub-millimeter fluxes and fit a modified black body with a fixed temperature that is reasonable, like 35 degrees Kelvin, we can estimate a redshift and a star formation rate for all the Herschel sources in a field. And what we obtain are these green points, which imply that these sources have total star formation rates of several thousands of solar masses per year and redshift mostly around 2 and 3. And this in purple, there are some non-Pluto cluster from the literature with some of the highest star formation rates known. So to study them further, we collected multi-wavelength data, optical and near-infrared imaging for more than 20 fields, Spitzer data for about 100, SCUBA data for 60, some CO data for about 20 fields, and then radio low far data are available for 144 fields, and not all of them are public, but they are very useful in investigating these sources. And slowly we are getting near infrared spectroscopy, which is very hard because these dusty galaxies are faint and in the optical and in the near infrared, so it requires big telescopes, and of course the sky is a problem. But we got some results, and I'm going to show you the first source we look at is a source with the 9 sigma over density of dusty star forming galaxy. This is a 2 arc minute image in the optical near infrared on one candidate. In magenta, you see the Herschel sources, and all the circles represent sources that have been targeted with X-shooter to get spectra in the near infrared. And out of the 18 sources that were targeted, 6 were found at a redshift of 2, including 1 EGN, and 3 at redshift of 1.7. And so this finding so many sources at the same redshift is unlikely, is not very likely. So this supports the idea that we have this Planck's emission is associated with structure and perhaps with multiple structures that are along the same line of sight. And then we also got ALMA data for another source, G73. Here you see the Herschel map. We target with ALMA the Herschel sources, which are shown with yellow contours in this near infrared image. And on average, we find that each Herschel source is made out of multiple ALMA sources from 1 to 5, which are shown by green or magenta circles. And in this case, we find out of 18 ALMA sources, 11 at the same redshift, the redshift 1.5, 1.55. So this is a lower redshift structure, but so it's a large number. And the redshift now, in this case, comes from CO data. And then we look at a source in the Cosmos field, the only Planck source in the field. Here is the Planck image, and here is the Herschel image. And the green contours correspond to the Planck emission. The total star formation rate from Planck for this source is 10,000 solar masses per year. And so we obtain spectroscopic data from the Large Binocular Telescope on this field. And also we were able to use the spectroscopic redshift available in Cosmos. And the spectroscopic redshift distribution in this field is shown in green, and in red and magenta, where I highlighted the two peaks that we find at redshift 2.16 and 2.20. And then compared to the median distribution, which is shown in black, these peaks are significant at 8 sigma and 5 sigma level. So this is a significant overdensity, and this is what we call a protocluster. Actually, these are two protoclusters that will become, according to models, clusters with the mass of about 4 or 5, 10 to the 14 solar masses, so like the Virgo cluster. And so I will focus on this object. since knowing the redshift at 2.16, we were able to use a narrowband filter, which is shown here, to detect H-alpha emitters at the same redshift. And this narrowband filter is available on Subaru, on the Mercs. And so we image this area in yellow, and the big image shows a 10 by 10 arc minute field where we have all the spectroscopic members in blue, and the H-alpha emitters are shown in yellow. And you see that the density of the H-alpha emitters and of the spectroscopic members coincides in this point that we call the protocluster core. The background image shows in red the Herschel emission, which is the tracer of star formation, in green the Spitzer emission, which is a tracer of mass, and in blue the X-ray emission from XMM, which is a tracer of AGN activity. And you see that in this region, core region, there is a purple background, which means that both star formation, Herschel emission, and AGN activity, traced by the X-ray emission, are observed in this core region. And this is not the case in the rest of the image. And indeed, we find a lot of X-ray AGN and dusty star-forming galaxies in the core. But we wanted to know whether this emission seen by Planck was associated with this structure at redshift 2.16. So we built a density map of red Herschel sources, which is shown here. And there is a peak that is in this density map that is significant at 5 sigma, which is a bit off from the Planck contours given here in white. But the position of this Planck source in the catalog is given with a large, axis, which is shown by this yellow ellipse. So this peak is consistent with the position given by Planck, but this offset is not observed in other sources. So it's intriguing, we don't understand. And then we look at the sum of all the flux from Herschel and compare it with the flux measured by Planck, and they are consistent. So we understand the Planck flux, we resolve it, and it can be attributed to all the Herschel sources. But which Herschel sources belong to the structure? To do that, we selected all the Herschel sources in this area, which is a zoom of this field. This is where we have the structure. The background image is the density map of Herschel sources. The purple contours are the Planck emission. And all the symbols correspond to Herschel sources with red colors that have either spectroscopic redshift at the redshift of the structure, just shown here in magenta, or they have photometric redshift greater than 1.4, which are shown in green, or they don't have photometric redshift in cyan. And there are several sources here because the white circle indicates a region where there is a bright star. And so in this region, there are no optical nor near-infrared data, and so photometric redshifts are not available. And then by looking at the radio emission and the far-infrared emission from Herschel of these sources, we were able to estimate the redshift. And out of these 86 sources, we estimate that there are only 11 that might belong to the structure. So it means that we understand the submillimeter emission from this region. There are several submillimeter sources. There is an excess of submillimeter sources associated with the structure, but most of the submillimeter emission comes from emission from foreground sources. So now that we have the members, we want to study their properties and compare them with the galaxies in the field. So we want to study their mass, the activity level, if they have enough gas to grow, or if they are going to quench soon. So we fitted their SEVs with SIGAL to estimate stellar masses. And here I'm showing the sources with the spectroscopic redshift with different colors according to the mass. And we see that the most massive objects are in the core. And the same result is found when we look at the H alpha meters, which are shown as these full squares, and the most massive ones, the red ones, are all in the core. We also look at star formation rates, again, estimated with SIGAL. And you see the sources with the largest star forming rates here in red are in the core. And we also see out of the four AGN, there are two, in here there are 20 sources. The two AGN out of these four are in the core. So this suggests that the star formation and the AGN activity are, might be fueled by the same mechanism, that this mechanism is favoring the densest region of the protoclusters. Although this is based on very few objects, so should be investigated by getting more members and looking at other protoclusters. And so by having masses and stellar masses, we can compare our sources with the main sequence of star formation, which is the relation between star formation rate and stellar mass. At the redshift of the structure, we expect the sources to be here. This is the dashed line is the main sequence. And basically all the spectroscopic members are on the main sequence. Sources above will be starburst, and sources below will be transitioning galaxies, those that are quenching. And so perhaps there are two, but the vast majority of them are on the main sequence. And if we look at other protoclusters from the literature at similar redshift, redshift 1.9 and 3, drawn from different selection, like from a high redshift radio galaxy field or a field where there is a sublimiter galaxy or through photometric selection, there are the different open symbols. The most of the members are on the main sequence. There are just a small fraction of sources that are starburst or that are quenching. The large symbol corresponds to median values in mass bins, and they agree very well between our source, which are the magenta symbols, and the protoclusters from the literature in green. And if we compare the total star formation rates, here I'm showing the total star formation rates for several protoclusters as full large symbols. And the star formation rates for single members are shown as open small symbols. So our source is here. If we look at the Planck total star formation rate, the 10,000 solar masses per year, we are well above all the others. But when we consider the one estimated with the confirmed members is this target symbol, we have a star formation rate of about 40,000 solar masses per year, which is consistent with all the other protocluster, no matter what the selection is. But what is interesting that is that all these measured values are well above predictions from simulations, which are shown here as in orange or green. This orange are the star formation rates predicted for the 25 most massive clusters. These are for the protoclusters. And so we are about a factor of 10 difference between the model predictions and observations. And so I can conclude. I show you, I hope that I convince you that these Planck fields contain star forming protoclusters with the star formation rates of several thousand solar masses per year, which are significant. But most of the Planck emission, the sublimiter emission, comes from star forming galaxies along the line of sight. Members are normal star forming galaxies. We are not finding this starburst that we were expecting to find. There is a tentative evidence that growth is favored in the densest region, and that in these regions we might find more AGN and star forming activity, and that we still have some work to do to understand these star formation rates in cosmological simulations. So for the future, we hope to get more near-infrared spectroscopic data to have more protocluster confirmed and be able to extend these studies to other protoclusters. And also we like to have high resolution millimeter observations that will allow us to identify the counterparts of the Herschel sources. And so to be able to have better estimates of star formation rates, stellar mass and gas fraction. And in the long term, Ideally, we would like to have Moon's data to be able to have identified members over large areas in a more efficient way. Euclid will provide photometry for most members. And then in the longer future, Athena might detect the proto-intracluster medium. And I finish here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary. Very nice talk. And since long time, the first perfectly on time.
I'm thank you. So
we have a lot of time for questions and comments. Please, I see in the list of participants a lot of people working in these topics. Not yet, so as usual. Let me start with a very naive question. You show some example with grid imaging. Do we have collecting all the data freely available or not? Large enough catalog of imaging in several wavelengths of proto clusters. If you wish to do some statistical analysis for the morphology of clusters based on analysis. Is there enough data or?
For a handful, not even a handful of protoclusters, there are enough members. And so what they see, for example, the spider web is a well-known protocluster at the same redshift as this one. And there are a lot of data on that one. I think it was the first discovered, and you see several clumps, so you can see different dark matter halos that will eventually merge, and you see there are filaments that connect these different clumps. Mm-hmm. And then there are others that where you see more like sort of a filament. So another problem with protoclusters is that people publish a list of members based on redshift or on the narrowband imaging, but then not everybody, it's hard to say whether it will become a cluster. I haven't shown it. I have done an estimate for this one. And so basically the 31 sources that I find will not end up in a cluster, but the two that in the two redshift peak will. So basically this system is made by two protoclusters. But both of them will collapse but to make this estimate, you need to make some assumption of linear growth and so many people they don't do this, and so you don't know if what they find will become a cluster. So if you have like a sort of a structure that can be a filament, probably that will not become a cluster, but
okay. So we cannot safely state whether a candidate protocluster is actually a protocluster. So that's
the point. Well, in some cases, in some cases, people find
you can do it with simulations. Or not?
Well, yeah, using simulations. Yeah, so you can do that.
Simulation, you can do it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a nice discrepancy between the location of the peak in the Herschel and Black data. Do you have any suggestion or explanation for the offset?
Well, the only
is it natural?
Planck is kind of blind. It doesn't focus very well, let's say. It has the fact that the position is given with an error or with a major and minor axis that are very large, so it could be extended. But it's also so the peak that we see in the Herschel sources is a bit off. But we don't see that in other cases. They usually match pretty well. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there is another structure that we don't see with this data, because it might be a higher redshift that might contribute there. But so far we don't see any evidence of that. But let's say that offset is consistent with the Planck position, considering that the Planck has a full width at half maximum of 5 arc minutes. So the offset is a bit less.
Clear. Thank you.
Carlo, I have a question.
Ciao Ale, please.
Oh. In one of your last plot, you show what is the expected star formation rate compared to models for this protocluster at high Z. Does have a sense? I mean, shouldn't you normalize to the size, to the total mass of the protocluster to make this kind of comparison?
Yes, of course. So this we took this simulations from another paper from Lim et al. And we are now selecting protoclusters in the TNG 300 simulations in the same way as we select our protoclusters. So considering the same kind of extent and the limit in star formation rate that we have with Herschel. And so I haven't shown the results because I didn't have enough time. This is work done by Céline Guan, I'm not sure. And so what we find is that we can reproduce the star formation rates, but we have some protoclusters for which we have redshift from CO, and the star formation rate that we have is basically produced by two sources, two Herschel sources that are detected in CO with a very large star formation rates. And in the simulations, to reproduce the star formation rates, we have 25 sources. So there is more than a factor of 10 sources. So there is still a mismatch. We don't understand. So, but if we try to do the same selection, yes, we reproduce the total, but not the same number of sources. In the simulation, there are 25, and in our structure, there are two sources that make all the star formation rate. I mean, those are, I say two because those are the sources for which we have the CO data. And so it's actually a lower limit to the total star formation rate. But those are very, they have star formation rates of hundreds of solar masses per year. In this simulation, a single galaxy doesn't have such a high star formation rate. Thank you for the question.
Interesting.
Guylaine,
yes.
Please.
Hi, Marie. Thanks for your talk. I have a question.
I don't hear you.
I'm sorry.
You muted.
I muted. Yeah, I was lowering the hand. Asked you unmute. Guylaine, do you hear us?
Okay.
I'm sorry, I muted you.
I didn't.
Yes, I have a question about something that we would like to do for a long time and we never did, but we can apply the same technique of the Planck selection at longer wavelengths, lower frequency. Because here what we did is that we kind of find an excess, a red excess at the 545 GHz channel, and that's pre-select object at redshift 1, 1, 2, 3, so as you know. It would be very interesting to do the same with the longer wavelengths to kind of try to find this kind of object at much higher redshift, right?
Well, I think, you might find sources that are a bit colder, and we don't expect colder sources to be so star forming. But I think there is room for discovery. ALMA is discovering a lot of these sources, and actually the sources also that we find when I measure temperatures, I kind of lower than than expected. So they are around 30 degrees Kelvin. So these are not what we find are not starbursts with temperatures of 50 degrees Kelvin. And so I think that that could be that could find some of the objects that are in this protoclusters. That the idea that this might be starburst, we don't see that. And again, you might find sources at higher redshift than this, because we were expecting sources up to redshift 4, but the highest redshift we find is 2.75. So if you look at the longer wavelengths, perhaps you'll find the higher redshift ones. Like they do with the SPT, oh, that's at a longer wavelength. But then you need a large field of view, I guess. I don't know if you have that.
Stan, please.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for your talk. Just about the star formation rate for individual galaxies. So you mentioned two galaxies with very high star formation rate. So they are not in the main sequence, I guess, those ones. Do you have any idea about the stellar mass? Can you accurately measure stellar mass for those objects? Or?
Okay, so those objects they are actually more than two. There are, let's say, two per field. So we have several fields. We have about almost 20 that we observe in CO. And in seven of these, in several fields, we find multiple sources at the same redshift through CO. We didn't look at many sources because with IRAM, we look at the brightest one. So, but when you find two at the same redshift, then it's a good hint that there is a structure at that redshift. And so for those sources, assuming that redshift and the Herschel flux, we estimate star formation rate. And is it possible that that star formation rate, that Herschel source is made out of multiple sources? We don't know because we don't have high resolution millimeter data. We would like to know that. But in any case, even if we take that star formation rate, and if we look at the CO, so the quantity of the mass of the gas mass, we find that they are where we expect normal star forming galaxy when you look at the Kennicott-Schmidt law, when you look at the gas mass and the star formation rate. We don't have the mass, even if we have Spitzer and optical near-infrared data, because we don't know which source is the counterpart of that CO emission. And that's why also we need the high-resolution millimeter data. And then we can get stellar masses and make a main sequence. In the case of the ALMA source, that's the only source for which we have ALMA data, so we could do that. And those sources are on the main sequence. And the star formation rates are, I think, perhaps 200 solar masses per year at the most. It's at the lower redshift. And in that case, we were able to deblend the Herschel flux because we knew how many sources contributed to it. Mm-hmm. And we also had the millimeter continuum to constrain the far infrared ACD. But for those that we detect with DIRAM, we don't have that information. But based on what we have done so far, I think they are on the main sequence. We might find a few above. But so they are also pretty massive if they are on the main sequence, as I expect.
Do you have signature of mergers?
Yes, we have in a couple of cases, we have a double peak CO line, which is not symmetric and which is suggested that there are two sources at the same redshift or very similar redshift. And then in one case, we have LOFAR data that have a resolution of 6 arc seconds that can pinpoint which may be the counterpart to the Herschel source, and there are we see two sources in the near infrared images that may be associated with this double peak. In the other case, we don't have that information in the optical, but so in two cases we have two sources that seem to be very close. So they are in the Aran beam, and they are at the same redshift because there are the two CO line. But so these are two out of 35 lines. So if there are mergers, it doesn't look like they are the predominantly mechanism to fuel these objects.
Philippe, you have a question or comment, please?
Can you expect to see groups?
Yes, I guess you can find systems that have lower mass, and they will not evolve into clusters, but they might evolve into groups. Yeah, so, but they will be still in a protophase. And when we look at these systems, we focus on the peak of the sublimeter emission where the dusty star forming galaxies are. But we know that many protoclusters are found as overdensities of Lyman alpha emitters. And those Lyman alpha emitters are not bright sublimeter sources. And so we are missing the population of Lyman alpha emitters, and the people that find Lyman alpha emitters or H alpha emitters, they miss the sublimeter sources because they don't overlap. And so what part of a protocluster are we seeing? Are we seeing really where the BCG will grow? That's what I would think, because this BCG must be this dusty star forming galaxy in the past. But we need to acquire multi-wavelength data and have this kind of observations for protoclusters to understand where all these different sources are and whether we are seeing protogroups, protoclusters, and how they will grow. But yeah, in theory, yes, we might see some protogroups.
Thank you.
I don't see any other raised hand. Is there any other comment or question? No, if not, thank you. Thank you again, Marie, for your seminar. I advertised next week Cafe Club. The speaker will be Tiago Costa, postdoctoral fellow at Max Planck in Göttingen, talking about very likely something about the AGN feedback. So let's see you next week, and take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.